You might not give cotton much thought until you're using a Q-tip or putting on a T-shirt, but cotton is all around us all the time, in the money we use, the books we read, soaps, and even the food that we eat. In his book, Empire of Cotton, A Global History, Sven Beckert writes, "Today, cotton is so ubiquitous that it's hard to see it for what it is, one of mankind's greatest achievements. But how does cotton get from the bolls growing in a field to the product that you hold in your hands or wear on your body?" Well, today's Please Explain is about just that. Joining us now are Sven Beckert, Laird Bell Professor of American History at Harvard University. His book is published by Knopf. And Mike Watson, Vice President of Fiber Competition for Cotton Incorporated. He manages the research related to creating better methods of fiber yarn and fabric testing. Sven, Mike, thanks for participating in today's Please Explain.
Good to be with you.
And
good afternoon.
And we invite our listeners to join in the act. If you have a question about cotton, you can give us a call at 212-433-9692 or leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org or tweet at Leonard Lopate. Sven, can you explain why you've said that cotton is one of mankind's greatest achievements? Is it a man-made achievement?
It is certainly a man-made achievement. Cotton has been one of humankind's most important industry for approximately 1,000 years, and it has a history of perhaps five millennia. And it was very important to the Industrial Revolution in the United Kingdom. It was very important to the role of the United States in the global economy. It was very important to changes within the Indian and West African economy. So it is a natural product. It obviously grows on fields, but the way how it has become central to the global economy is entirely a human-made process.
Isn't it a rare instance of a shrub that's native to so many different parts of the world? The Americas, Africa, India. I've heard that the greatest diversity of wild cotton species is found in Mexico.
Right. And the species of cotton that is now grown predominantly around the world originates also from Mexico. The cotton emerged in very many different parts of the world. As you just mentioned, Africa, Central America, and South Asia were the most important ones. And from those parts of the world, it spread into other parts of the world, such as Western Asia, into China, into West Africa, and elsewhere. And it is characterized by great biological diversity, yes.
Well, they were actually making cotton before they made pottery in the Andes.
Right.
You want to jump in here, Mike? You know about that?
Well, going back into the distant history of cotton is not my area of expertise because I tend to work more with the cottons that we have today.
So let's talk about those, and we'll get back to the history in a little bit. Are there different types of cotton plants that are being worked with today, Mike?
Oh, certainly there are. Commercially, there are two basic species of cotton that are in high economic use throughout the world. There are the Barbadense cottons, which are long staple, like Egyptian or Pima. And then by far more prevalent is the hirsutum species, or what we call upland cottons. And those are far more commercially prevalent, although they're slightly lower quality.
Are they used for different purposes?
Oh, absolutely. The extra long staple tends to go into higher end luxury goods.
That's why we hear that Egyptian cotton is so great.
Yes. Egyptian, Pima, there's also those cottons are also grown in Peru to some extent, and in China, believe it or not. But then the upland is more of the workhorse of the world. It's in the goods that you and I would tend to use every day, like a polo shirt or sheeting.
What does a cotton plant look like, and how is it harvested?
Well, a cotton plant varies greatly depending upon where it's growing. It's anywhere from 2 feet tall up to 6 or 7 feet tall in some uncontrolled situations. It can be almost be a bush because cotton is a perennial and will continue to grow in for a long, long time, although it won't be particularly productive. Now, for harvesting, the traditional method is hand harvesting, and that is still done in about 60% of the world.
They don't use the cotton gin?
Well, no, this is for cotton harvesting, actually removing the fiber from the plant. Probably 60 to 65% of the cotton harvested in the world is still done by hand. Now, in developing countries like Australia, United States, Brazil, 100% mechanical harvesting. Very large industrial machines that can, one machine can literally take the place of 1,000 people in the field.
Sven, I want to go back to the history. What's the earliest evidence of its use? It was developed independently in both the old and the new worlds without people knowing that the other people were doing it.
Right. So as far as we know, the use of cotton fiber to produce yarn and cloth is approximately 5,000 years old, and it developed independently in three different areas of the world. The oldest evidence that we have for the production of cotton fiber, cotton yarn and cotton cloth comes from what is today Pakistan, and that dates back to approximately 5,000 years in the past. Shortly thereafter, but unknown, they didn't know about these developments. Farmers in what is today Peru also harvested cotton fiber and used them for the production in yarn and cloth. And then perhaps another 1,000 to 2,000 years later, farmers in East Africa did the same. So it originated in these three different parts of the world. And then, as I mentioned earlier, it spread into other parts of the world throughout Asia, throughout Africa, up and down the Americas. And by the year 1000 of the Common Era, it became the most important industry that humans engaged in. It was very important to the manufacturing activities of farmers in Africa and Asia and in Central America. But the one part of the world that did not play an important role in that early cotton industry was the continent of Europe, which, of course, eventually, by the 19th century, came to dominate the world's cotton industry. And in some ways, my book explains why that happened and what the implications of that shift were.
But before then, did the ancient peoples around the world come up with similar methods for making it into fabrics, even though they didn't know about each other?
Yeah, I mean, they were broadly similar. They used spindles to spin the cotton into thread, and they used looms to weave it. But the particular way what these looms looked like, they were slightly different. But for example, in South Asia, what was typical is that farmers would hang a loom between two trees, and they would weave the cotton fabric sitting on the ground between these trees, and that was broadly similar in other areas of the world, but then there was innovation. So, for example, in the approximately 1,000 years ago, the spinning wheel was invented, and it was invented probably in China or in South Asia, and eventually the spinning wheel, as you know, migrated from these parts of the world into Europe, and the spinning wheel was a way of spinning cotton that was vastly more productive than the earlier ways of spinning cotton.
In Mexico, I saw women who strapped their looms to their backs and then attached them to trees and wove that way. The fabric was as wide as their bodies.
Right. That would be something you would also have found in Africa and South Asia, and to some degree you still find it to this day.
Now, I assume that when it came to Europe, Italy and some of the Southern Europe would have gotten it first. How long did it get to Northern Europe and to England?
Right. So the first time Europeans engaged in the manufacturing of cottons was in the 12th century. And this happened in the hinterland of the port of Venice. As you know, Venice expanded into the what today is the Middle East, to the Eastern Mediterranean. And in the Eastern Mediterranean at this point in time, there was already a thriving cotton industry, and especially they grew cotton there. And the Venetians exported that cotton from there into Italy, and there was a fairly thriving cotton industry emerging in Italy in the 12th and 13th century. That industry eventually, by the 16th and by the 17th century, so much later, half a millennium later, migrated to Northern Europe. And it migrated to Northern Europe at the exact point when the Mediterranean trade relations became less important than the trade relations in the Atlantic world, especially to the Americas, North and South America. And it was approximately the year 1600 that for the first time cotton was manufactured in the United Kingdom. So this is about 400 years ago, but it remained a relatively marginal industry. It was not particularly important to the economy of the United Kingdom. It was not particularly important to the economy of Europe in general.
And because they had made their commitment to wool?
They made the textiles out of wool and out of linen, and cotton was an exotic fabric. It was, you know, it was very difficult to access raw cotton because it didn't grow on the continent of Europe, and they also had to compete with the products of South Asian producers, of South Asian spinners and weavers who produced beautiful cottons of extremely high qualities, and these cottons increasingly found their way into the European markets because of the expansion of Europe into Asia, in the 16th and 17th centuries.
Mike, now the cotton ball is this coarse thing full of seeds. How does it become yarn or thread?
Well, after the cotton is harvested, we send it to the cotton gin at that point. And actually, the modern cotton gin is a high-speed version of what we saw during the time of Eli Whitney. It really hasn't changed a great deal. You have saws that literally pull the cotton hairs, or what most people would call fibers, from the seed. From there, those fibers are packed into bales, and we go through in a textile mill, we go through a series of cleaning steps and fiber alignment steps that we call carding before those aligned fibers are spun into a yarn.
And when you talked earlier about long and short staple cotton, that is just the nature of the cotton plant itself, or is that also part of the process?
That comes from the cotton genetically. Some of it is controlled by growing conditions, but predominantly genetics. Longer cottons can be spun into finer, stronger yarns because more of the fibers are interacting, whereas shorter fibers are better for relatively coarse yarns like would go into a denim jean or an industrial canvas.
And how long is long?
Long would be an inch and a half on average. Short would be 1 inch. Cotton is measured in 32nds of an inch for commercial trading. And there are people that can look at it and tell how long it is just by experience. But we tend to measure it all by instruments today.
We are going to take a little break, and we'll come back with more Please Explain This Look at Cotton with Mike Watson, Vice President of Fiber Competition for Cotton Incorporated, and Sven Beckert, who's written a history of cotton, in fact, a global history called Empire of Cotton. It's published by Knopf. And we will take your calls, some calls at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. We are back with our Please Explain Look at Cotton. Invite your calls at 212-433-9692 or your comments on our show page at WNYC.org. My guest is Sven Beckert, who has written Empire of Cotton, A Global History. It's published by Knopf, and Mike Watson, Vice President of Fiber Competition for Cotton Incorporated. Sven, it's unfortunately impossible to think about cotton's early history in America without thinking about slavery.
Right.
What roles did slaves play in supporting and developing the industry?
one of the arguments of my book. So my book tells the history, the global history of cotton over a period of 5,000 years, but it does so trying to understand the history of capitalism in the past 500 years or so. And one thing that you find when you look at the history of the global cotton industry, you encounter a puzzle of how it was that Europe, that, as I mentioned before, had not been particularly important to the global cotton industry, how Europe suddenly became, in the late 18th and early 19th century, in the age of the Industrial Revolution, why Europe became so important to this industry. And one of the reasons I'm arguing why that happened is that Europeans, unlike producers in other parts of the world of cotton fabrics, Europeans were able to source cotton from another part of the world, namely from the Americas, and that part of the world was principally characterized by the fact that huge amounts of land were available, land that was taken from its native inhabitants, and then also huge amounts of human labor were available, and this was the labor of enslaved Africans who came to grow the world's cotton. The connection between slavery and cotton began in the course of the 18th century. It began in the Caribbean. It then moved, by the 1780s, it moved to Brazil, and by the 1790s, it moved to the United States. And as you know, the United States became then the dominant producer of cotton for European markets, so much so that by 1850, 80% of all cotton manufactured in Europe and also in the industry in the northern part of the United States came from the United States and was grown by slave labor. So slave labor became absolutely essential of the kind of industrializing global economy of that age of Industrial Revolution.
When did cotton become a more important cash crop in the South than tobacco?
Pretty rapidly by the very first years of the 19th century. So for a long time, the United States did not produce much cotton. Cotton is indigenous to the United States, but very little cotton was grown in the United States, and very little was grown for commercial purposes. But with the decline of tobacco growing in the Upper South, there was much slave labor available. With the territorial expansion of the United States through the Louisiana Purchase and then later into Texas and so on, there was a lot of labor, land available for the growing of cotton, and cotton became the dominant crop of the American South. It was the crop that was grown by the vast majority of enslaved Africans in the American South, and exports of cotton became the single most important export product of the United States all the way until the American Civil War. So the United States economy began to matter to the global economy principally because of the slave-grown cotton of the American South.
How did the cotton industry landscape change in the United States when slavery was abolished?
It changed dramatically. It now was based on a very different system of labor. With the end of slavery in 1865, it was mostly sharecroppers and tenant farmers in the American South who would grow cotton for global markets. There was a further territorial expansion of cotton agriculture, especially into what is Texas and Oklahoma. And these parts of the country, and though there was a slight reduction in the production of cotton in the wake of the American Civil War, eventually by the 1880s and 1890s, the United States produced more cotton for global markets than it ever had been during slavery times.
And Mike, isn't the United States still the largest exporter of cotton in the world?
Yes, it is. The U.S. typically exports between 10 and 12 million bales a year, and we domestically consume between 3.5 and 4 million. So we are the leading exporter in global cotton markets today.
Now, we mentioned that things changed a bit when Eli Whitney invented the cotton gin. Is the basic concept of the cotton gin still being used today in more advanced technology?
Yes, the modern gin has a great deal of mechanization and a lot of electronics and process control, but the fundamentals of removing that hair or fiber from the seed are fundamentally the same as Whitney's invention. You hold the seed in place in a saw
passes through the fiber and pulls it from the seed.
Now, the cotton industry has figured out ways to treat cotton differently to get it to serve different purposes. For instance, we've been seeing a lot of wrinkle-resistant cotton. I assume that was developed because of inroads made by synthetic fabrics.
Well, certainly the synthetic competition forces you to work to improve your product. The development of wrinkle resistance was originally done by a group of researchers at the U.S. Department of Agriculture in New Orleans, and it's been an essential element in keeping cotton competitive in certain markets such as dress shirts and men's slacks and women's slacks.
Sven, a listener, Bobby, wants to know when cotton was first used to make paper.
Oh, I'm sorry, I don't know that exactly, but presumably that has a very, very long history too. Sometimes the problem with dating these things is that that paper, just like textiles, they don't last very well. So it is very difficult to exactly date when the earliest when this was done for the first time. But I would assume that it is a history that is nearly as long as the use of textile fibers for the making of yarn and cloth.
And cotton, paper with a lot of cotton content is generally considered higher quality.
Right.
Because
It's much longer lasting. Yeah.
Mike, you also talk about some of the other things that cotton is being used in. For medical purposes? Obviously, that we know what those sterilized pads and things, but you say that it's in a lot of the food that we eat. Hot dogs?
Yeah, that surprises a lot of people that. The cotton, the oil from the cotton seed is an important food product in many of the foodstuffs out there. And also cotton seed meal is important as a protein source, particularly for, say, dairy cow feeds.
Now, when did people start using the cotton seed and putting it in food? Was it just something that was left over? They didn't know what to do with it, so... they came up with Crisco?
Yes. I mean, it's like most farm products. You've got something there, and you figure out, hey, does it have an economic value? And that's what people did with cottonseed. Today, we look at things like gin byproducts, which most people would look at and say, hey, that's trash. Well, we're finding unique uses for those cotton gin byproducts. Things like erosion controls on the side of highways.
Now, what part of the cotton goes into a hot dog, a potato chip, or ice cream? Is it all in the form of cottonseed oil?
Yes, it would be predominantly the cottonseed oil. The cottonseed meal is used more for animal feeds.
And isn't cottonseed oil also used to make soaps?
Oh, yes. I mean, it has a lot of the properties that you need for manufacturing of soaps and other items that you would see, a lanolin or other kinds of grease products in.
A caller wonders if either of you can explain where corduroy comes from.
Well, I can start by saying corduroy is a special type of weave that has a lot of floating yarns, and then those yarns are actually cut by a wire, which causes them to stand up in the pile that you associate with corduroy. Very difficult to explain this without visuals.
A lot of listeners have been inquiring about both labor practices involved in harvesting cotton and also in its environmental impact, because so much water is required to grow it. Can either of you address that?
Yeah, I think these are very very important and good questions of your listeners. And the environmental impact of the growing of cotton is certainly quite significant. Cotton is a very thirsty crop. It needs a lot of water supplies.
Isn't it hard on soil as well?
And it can be hard on soil, absolutely. That's one of the reasons why the cotton growing in the United States moved from the east, from places like North and South Carolina, further west because of the diminishing quality of soils. But that can partly be addressed by the use of chemical fertilizers. And cotton is indeed a very chemistry-intensive crop. It uses a lot of fertilizers and insecticides and other such things. And so the environmental impact in some regions of the world is really quite dramatic. If you look at Central Asia, which is another major producer of cottons for world markets, you can see that the use of water has of huge amounts of water for cotton production has led to true environmental devastation. The Aral Lake, for example, has basically been pumped dry in order to feed the cotton fields of Central Asia. So this is certainly an important concern. And when it comes to labor practices, obviously one of the arguments of my book is that there's a huge diversity, both in terms of change over time as well as in place. The labor regimes in the long history of cotton industry range from everything, from households growing cotton and spinning it at home to huge slave plantations emerging in the Americas to the emergence of industrial wage work in New England and on the continent of Europe, to the use of children in factories in the 18th century and to the use of children in the cotton harvesting in Uzbekistan in the year 2000 and 14. As Mike mentioned, there are still very significant parts of the world in which cotton is harvested by hand, and often children are encouraged or forced to participate in that harvest. So there's a huge diversity of labor regimes in cotton, and one of the points of my book is exactly to explain why there is that diversity.
Now, one more thing, Mike. What are American growers doing to eliminate some of the problems that cotton can cause to their land?
Well, certainly, if you use cotton as a monoculture, you can generate some issues. But that's very rare in much of the production of the U.S. Cotton is part of a rotation among corn and soy and other types of agricultural products. And from that aspect, cotton in the U.S. is not that thirsty a fiber. Two-thirds of the cotton grown in the United States is grown solely with rainwater as a water source, not with irrigation water. The productivity of cotton without commensurate increases in inputs has also come into play. I mean, we have globally decreased land use for cotton by about 30% over the last 30 years, while at the same time doubling the production of fiber. So all of these things have an impact.
Good.
From the viewpoint of harvesting, a modern harvesting system in the U.S. requires two people and can harvest between 70 and 100 acres per day. So the actual unskilled labor component can be reduced to almost an inconsequential level.
Now, Sven, in just the few moments we have left, how does cotton production in China and India, which are actually the largest producers of cotton, if not the largest exporters, how does that compare to the United States?
Right. So this is important. It was mentioned earlier that the United States is still the world's most important cotton exporter, which is definitely true, but it's partly a function of the fact that the United States itself does not use very much cotton anymore in manufacturing enterprises. But the largest producers of cotton in the world today are China and India, and taken together, they produce about 50% of the world's cotton crop. And China, in particular, is also the world's most significant producer of cotton yarn and cotton cloth. And the production in these countries, again, is very, very diverse. There are certainly huge cotton plantations, in especially in China, which are heavily mechanized.
We have to leave it there, unfortunately. We've run out of time. Sven Beckert, his book, Empire of Cotton, A Global History from Knopf. Mike Watson, Vice President of Fiber Competition for Cotton Incorporated. Thank you both so much.